You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
Hello, Mom? This is Ralph. Judy and Frank want me to stay for dinner. Is it all right with you?
Welcome to episode 210 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Simon Appleton from The Movie Mustache to discuss a 1988 film that, even though it's a forgotten film, has one of the most memorable titles of the 80s. Starring Hub Staple and Monique Van de Ven, directed by Dick Moss, it's Amsterdam. But first...
Cities are built of something that's far more important than steel and brick and stone. What holds a city together is...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor. Served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty with a bit of spice. Buy one now. Taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly, speeding your order for a real Chili Dilly.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
He lives.
Frankenstein creates the ultimate
in evil.
Frankenstein created woman.
What is it for? What is it for? To give life after death, my friend, that's what it's for. Life after death.
A beautiful woman with the soul of the devil. See... Frankenstein, the created woman. Beware the feet of the cloth-wrapped feet. Beware the mummy shroud and Frankenstein created woman.
Is there life on Mars? For centuries we have wondered. Now, for the first time, through the new photographic miracle of Cinemagic, you will see the wonders of this strange and terrifying world when you see the Angry Red Planet. Join this daring crew, the first in the scientific race between nations to attempt to land on Mars.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
Blast off from Earth with courageous astronauts Gerald Moore, Nora Hayden, Les Tremaine, Jack Crucian. Travel thousands of miles through space to the unknown. Cinemagic is not being shown to you now, but this wild land comes alive in Cinemagic. You'll see buildings miles high in Cinemagic. Journey to the center of sudden terror in Cinemagic. Be trapped by the tentacles of man-devouring plants in Cinemagic. Feel the fire-hot breath of a 40-foot monster as it reaches for you in Cinemagic. Your eyes will see the wonders of a world no eyes in this world have ever seen before.
I wonder, will we ever get back to Earth?
And now, on with the show.
Worker in the morning shift found a boat.
Nobody at the factory saw anything?
They had a shutdown last night for maintenance work. The two-night watchman claimed they saw nothing.
Hi, Eric.
What were they doing?
Apparently, they were collecting water samples.
They were the ones who ended up getting sampled.
The killer, think it's the same?
Serial murderer?
Huh.
Want to see the autopsy first. But it's very unlikely that there'd be more than one of this kind of killer.
I want you, buddy. Give me that camera. You don't want to listen.
Here it is.
That's your
ass.
Hey,
man, take it easy. You don't have to get rough.
Just give me that camera, wise guy.
Hey, come on, don't break it.
You try it again and I'll ram that lens down your throat.
Look who it is. Holland Sean Penn.
I don't like to be photographed. Hello, Eric.
John? It's a long time.
13 years, Eric.
Oh, Eric, this is John Van Meegeren of the River Police.
I've met him. Come to assist us, you got a big rap.
They thought you might need help. We're good at getting stiffs out of the water.
Van Meer, look at this.
The years haven't changed you.
You're right.
You're still prettier than I am.
Are you still angry with me?
It hurts when someone runs off with your girl.
I found it out, too.
The grapevine said that she dumped on you.
Yeah, John, you heard right. An English artist. They were living in London last I heard, left me with my daughter. She visits her at Christmas.
It's water under both our bridges. But don't do that again.
No intention. Your guys found anything yet?
Not yet. We are combing the bottom. The channel down there is so murky it makes searching difficult. They've got something.
What is it?
Depth meter. Standard equipment for a diver.
Are we dealing with a diver?
We can't tell that at this stage. I want this analyzed. Bring it to the lab. I want to know how long it's been down there and where it comes from.
Okay.
A psycho killer in Amsterdam's famed canals.
That's not going to enhance our good reputation.
We're looking forward to quite a summer.
Okay, our movie this time is Amsterdammed from 1988. And joining me to discuss this film is Simon Appleton from The Movie Mustache. Simon, it's been a while, but welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Yeah, I apologize for it being so long, but it's a pleasure to have you back on. And actually, it's funny because I know the last time you were on the show, we talked about Raise the Titanic. And this week, we also are dealing with water in a lot of ways. You just you seem to get the shows where we deal with water, I guess.
It's nice to have a running theme.
Yeah, yeah, an unintentional running theme, but it's one nonetheless. So, but before we get too far into that, why don't you take a moment here, tell everybody a bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, as you've already pointed out, I'm from the movie Mustache. That's my site. That's what I wrote, or where I write when I get the chance to write these days. Generally just an all-round movie geek who loves talking and writing about movies as much as watching them, so... This will be fun. Haven't done this in a while. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, and I have to ask, I know I'm pretty sure I asked you this the last time you were on the show, but it's been so long. There's always new listeners. And whenever there's a unique site name, I always have to ask folks, where did that name come from?
Well, at the time I started writing this, of wanting to get to writing, we had where I work, we had a whole bunch of company, yay, look at us posters put up. And a couple of my buddies who I trained with initially were on the front, and they're looking all amazing and staring off into the distance. And I just looked at them and went, no, I know you two. I know what you're like, and that's not you. And for some reason, at the end of a 12-hour night shift, I thought it'd be hilarious to draw a mustache on one of them, the one who was clean-shaven, not knowing that the boss of the organization was coming to visit that day. So our acting immediate boss at the time was very angry and was chasing up all the shift managers to find out whoever had committed this massive offense. And of course I owned up, and the guy was a bit of a tool about it. I've never been sent an email asking me to arrange an appointment for a telling off. And yeah, so it was originally Mustache Movie News, and then I changed it to the Movie Mustache because it kind of flows a bit better. And, I've been doing this 9 years now.
Awesome. Awesome. So you were that guy, you brought to life, I think there's a Looney Tunes cartoon where the criminal goes around and is drawing mustaches on everyone, and so on the posters and all that stuff. So you lived out a Looney Tunes cartoon. I mean, we all should aspire to such things.
You got to make life fun. That's what I think. You got to make life fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you've got a lot of things going on there on your site. You know, I know you have reviews, you have trailer reactions, things like that. We're moving into a new year here. It's February, but, you know, it's new enough. There's always lots of new stuff hitting. What's got you excited for 2024 at the movies?
Dune at the moment. I will admit, Dune Part 2. I loved the first one and can't wait to see the second one. I don't get to the cinema as much as I used to, but I'm definitely looking forward to that one.
I've been making much more of an effort to get to the movies the last year or so. And, you know, of course, the Dune trailer has been playing a lot. I mean, especially because it was going to be released in December and then it got delayed. So that just means the trailer has been running even longer. And that,
if I remember right, it was going to release around about my birthday. And I was like, I turned to my missus and I said, that's what I want for my birthday. I'm going to see that at the cinema. And then they delayed it, and I kind of looked like an idiot. Damn, but never mind.
Both of those Dune movies got delayed. I mean, the first one got delayed because of COVID stuff, and so I guess they had to do it with the second one as well. It's been weird for me, though, the last few weeks going to the movies, because not only have they been playing the trailer for Dune Part 2, but they've also been playing a trailer for, they're doing some screenings of the David Lynch film from 1984. Wow. It's like a Fathom Events thing, and so, like, you're sitting there in the theater, and they run this Dune trailer. And I've wondered sometimes if there's people that are not as up to date on movies, if they're getting a little confused because they're seeing Sting and Kyle MacLachlan on the screen.
Yeah, a very youthful Sting and Kyle MacLachlan and Patrick Stewart as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's so many great people in that movie. I admit to having a soft spot for the David Lynch Dune. I admit all its flaws, but I have a lot of fun with that movie, especially considering that movie creeped me out like crazy back in 84, because it's David Lynch. But today I don't know. There's so much about that movie that I find intriguing. So I love the chance to revisit it.
It's funny how movies look different as you get older. You look back at movies and you think, oh, I loved that when I was a kid. And then you watch it and you think, why did I like this? Because this is terrible.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
then other movies. I remember the first time I saw Pulp Fiction, I was far too young to appreciate it, and I didn't enjoy it that much. And then later on, I think my brother said to me, what the hell's the matter with you? That's a great film. And I watched it again. I was like, yeah, he's right. I'm an idiot.
I can imagine, you know, if you're at a certain age and you see Pulp Fiction, that can do some weird things to you as well. I mean, it's definitely one of those films where it's kind of like, you got to be a certain age, I think, for this.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, we're all guilty of those films that we watched far too young. Well, speaking of that type of thing, I didn't intend that as a segue, but speaking of that, I know one of the things you mentioned to me as we were communicating before getting ready for this show is that since the last time you were on the show, you have become a parent.
I have.
And, of course, one of the things that I, as a parent, have always enjoyed is, you know, trying to raise my kids with an appreciation for movies, if not movies as a whole, but you know, maybe just certain movies, you know, that I wanted to make sure I exposed them to at a young age. Both my kids are adults now, but you being a new parent, I'm curious, are you on that journey of trying to turn your offspring into a movie geek?
Oh, definitely. He woke up from his nap once, this was a while ago now, and I was watching Star Wars: A New Hope, and it was just at the point where Luke's flying down the trench in his X-Wing, and he sort of was on the sofa, and he sort of just rose up, looked around, saw me, saw the telly, and watched the end of Star Wars, and I was very proud that day.
yeah, I've experienced that as well. I mean, Star Wars was one that was right there on the list to introduce to my kids at a certain age and have them, you know, relive what I did. You know, I saw it when I was 6 years old in 1977 when it came out. So nice. I wanted them to have that same experience. Are there certain films that you've kind of got on like a mental list that you're like, when the time is right, I must expose my child to this?
Back to the Future and Die Hard would be high ones for me. I remember my sister, my mum remarried and she had two more kids. And I have a real great connection with the younger sister. And she gets her love of movies from me. She's always messaging me to say, oh, I've been to see this, I've been to see that. But she, when she was little, she came to me and she said, what's your favourite Christmas movie? And I said, Die Hard. And she's like, what's that? And so I explained it to her. And she's, you know, your kids wide-eyed, mouth open. And it was like, oh, wow. That sounds so cool. So, Mom, can Cordy watch Die Hard? Yes, don't look at me like that. Yeah, can she watch Die Hard? It's like, go on then. You watch it with her. Make sure she's all right. And I said to her, you cannot tell anyone you've watched this because you really shouldn't be watching it at this age. And she went to school the next day. I saw an 18. It's like, I won't repeat the words. I was cursing. But yeah, those two are behind my list. I will say, Disney Plus, whether you love it or you hate it, I love it. It is an amazing tool when it comes to not parenting, but in terms of sometimes surviving. Like my poor son had a viral infection. We were at the hospital yesterday with him because he spiked a temperature almost 39 degrees, and that's centigrade for all you American yeah. listeners.
I was going to say, I have to adjust, but I get where you're going.
Anyway, and obviously, had to wait in the waiting room at the hospital. It was sort of, we got there 6 p.m. So he's like 2 hours off of going to bed and all of that. And he sat on my lap the entire time. He was good as gold. And I had my iPhone and we watched, what was it, Moana and Finding Nemo whilst waiting for the docs to come along. Obviously Friday night, very busy. And I will say NHS is wonderful and they did a great job. They would treat us really well. But as I say, we sat there and we watched those two movies, and I don't know why, he just likes sitting on his dad's lap watching movies, which is actually really cool.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. That's great. I've definitely experienced that same type of thing. Of course, when I was doing it with my kids, it was the early days of DVD. We probably whipped out a VHS occasionally, you know, on that. We weren't able to watch them on our phones yet at that point.
No.
But you know, it is great. I mean, to have all of those things at your fingertips. I mean, I think about it, and you know, some of the movies that, you know, I would have sat my kids down with when they were sick at that age, you know, we're talking about the things like, you know, Snow White and Cinderella and Alice in Wonderland and the Jungle Book and things like that. And, you know, those are the things that for me as a kid, I only got to see them, you know, on the 7-year cycle when Disney yep. re-released them every 7 years. And now they're right there at your fingertips. And I've actually been kind of reliving a bit of that myself because I'm gearing up to actually go on a trip to Walt Disney World later this year. Just my wife and I. The kids are staying home because they're adults now. but, you know, I'm like, I want to watch some of these classic Disney movies again before doing that. So I've been, you know, putting on, like, I put on Lady and the Tramp the other day. And I was just like, oh, this is just so great to be able to just push a few buttons. And they're the classics. So that's great.
Yep.
So. Well, let's move on to our movie we have here today. Not a classic, because that's not what we talk about on this show. We talk about forgotten films. But this is one I always had a vague memory of the title in the back of my head from back in the 80s, because it's just got such a great, weird title. This is Amsterdammed from 1988. This is a Dutch film. It's directed by a guy named Dick Maas. And he actually is a busy guy, according to the credits of this film, because he not only directed it, but he also wrote the film and he composed the score. So he's got multiple skills going on here.
Yeah.
But he actually first achieved success as the director of several music videos for the Dutch band Golden Earring. And then he went on to direct a number of films. Beyond this, there was also the 1983 horror film The Lift, as well as three films in the Dutch comedy franchise Flodder. I hope I'm saying that right. I have no idea. I'm not familiar with Flodder.
But, it sounds right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, really, all of his other films, I can't say that I am familiar with them. But like I said, I do remember seeing ads for Amsterdammed back in the late 80s. This one did get a very limited theatrical release in the U.S. And like I said, it's just got one of those memorable titles that made dumb teenagers like me and my friend snicker because we're like, Amsterdammed. You know, that sounds weird. According to IMDb trivia, Maas was also offered the chance to direct one of the Nightmare on Elm Street films, but he turned it down and did this instead. So I guess we'll find out if that was a good choice for him or not. As far as the what this film is all about, this takes place in Amsterdam. Go figure. And it concerns a string of murders happening around the city at night. Dare we say a serial killer appears to be on the loose. Now, the first murder that plays out as the film begins is of a local prostitute. And the grisly crime is discovered the next morning when a tour boat going through the city's famous canals literally bumps into the body, which is hanging from one of the little bridges that goes over the water. Now, on the case is a police detective named Eric Visser, played by Hub Staple. He's a hardworking single parent. He's trying to raise a sassy 13-year-old daughter while also up to his neck in police work. When there ends up being another grisly murder of some environmentalists who are taking water samples from the river, Eric teams up with an old friend who works for the river police, John Van Meegeren. I'm going to mess up names all over the place here with this, played by Wim Zomer. And the two soon begin to realize that this killer they are seeking seems to be working out of the water, meaning that he is scuba diving, emerging from the water and then killing people. And this, of course, baffles everyone because the canals in Amsterdam are notoriously filthy and not the sort of place one would want to go scuba diving in. Now, the detectives begin investigating a local diving club where they meet the wealthy Martin Roysdale, played by Hyde Maas, and the lovely Laura, played by Monique Van de Ven. And Eric, of course, starts to take a romantic interest in her. Meanwhile, the killer continues to wreak havoc around the city, attacking people in crazy ways. Now, like I said, this film had a limited release here in the U.S., not a big hit, but it did develop a bit of a following, so much so that a few years ago, the director announced that he was actually working on a sequel that I think they're thinking about a release for 2025. I guess we'll see if that actually happens, but we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves here. I'm going to let Simon start us out. Give us a few of your thoughts on Amsterdammed.
Well, I'd heard that title before. I didn't know what it was about. But obviously when you got in touch, I looked it up and I thought, yeah, that looks like fun. And it is in my mind, it is a very, it's like the Dutch take on the Hollywood 80s cop movie with horror elements thrown in. And if that's what you're looking for, it delivers it perfectly. You could literally watch it with a checklist of all the 80s movie cop cliches, and you've got it. You've got the mullet, you've got the cool car and apartment, you know, you've got his hard as nails, and he doesn't play by the rules, but he's dedicated to the job. Like, I love the scene where he's stuck in traffic because the delivery truck is in front of him, and he just happens to see the guys doing the protection racket, and he just gets out of the car, leaves his car running, even though it's actually quite a nice looking Alfa Romeo, I think, and just wanders into the shop and just like, "All right, guys, what are you doing?"
yeah. Well, and even when he foils that crime in process, the shop owners aren't terribly thrilled with him. They're mad because he messes up the beautiful cake that they made.
I had quite a lot of fun with this. It was, you could see some of the twists coming, I suppose, but it just draws you. It was enough of a mystery to draw you in, and the antics were cool enough. I mean, the speedboat chase was pretty cool, and the chase before that was pretty cool. I love the way that chase ends. The sort of, they just get out of the car and look up at him, and it's like, what are you doing? they don't even have to say anything. It's just the look on their faces. And what I really liked was, because they did the English dub, obviously, the three main actors who speak English actually dubbed themselves, which I thought was a nice touch, because you're essentially just adding to your own performance. You're not letting someone else put their spin on it, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Well, and I've always wondered, whenever I watch movies that are dubbed like this, I often wonder, you know, am I losing something in the translation here? You know, how much can I really, you know, evaluate the performance of the lead actors, because part of it's not them, or maybe, you know, they translated something slightly different than what it would have been before, and might change the meaning of things. You know, for all I know, I'm experiencing different things differently than I would if I was able to experience in the language that it was made. And here, I think, you know, I can't say for certain, but I think that having those actors do their own voices here, I mean, it just is, like you say, a kind of a chance to enhance what they've already done. And, you know, there were certainly moments in this where I was kind of like, this doesn't feel dubbed at all.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think one of the things that really sold it for me was, obviously, going into it, you know that there's the serial killer, you know he's using the canals, but it was the POV shots. It was really well done. Like the way that he wasn't just perfectly floating on the water. He would go underwater and then he'd raise back up. And it gave the whole thing a really creepy vibe. Like, it's not one of these ones where you see the villain and you see the cops and you think, well, they're going to intersect at some point. I actually was watching this thinking they've actually got a really tough job on their hands, because they've got all the people above them yelling at them to solve the case. But it's one of those ones where they're literally waiting on the killer to do something, because he's never in view. He's never a presence that they're aware of. And it gives it a really creepy vibe. And so I like that sort of combination of detective action horror that's all sort of mixed in together. I thought it worked really well.
I agree with that. And I think that, you know, the opening credits sequence, you know, does that really, really well. That, you know, the whole opening credits is primarily where we're seeing things from the killer's point of view. And like you said, he's kind of, you know, bobbing in and out of the water. We see, you know, we see his view looking around. We see the bridges and such, the city, and then it dips down and it goes dark and pops up back up again. And we see a bit of view. And I'm sure part of that is a creative bit of editing, you know, when he goes under the water, it's a chance to make a cut and all that stuff. But I really appreciated the way they kind of set up not only the mysterious nature of the killer here, but also the just kind of the seedy side of Amsterdam. I mean, you know, what they're doing here, I've never been to Amsterdam. I don't know what it's really like. No. But this is not what the Chamber of Commerce would like to promote. This is not, you know, the tourism board isn't going to use this movie to promote things, because it really is presenting the city as being – not that pretty a place. I mean, even in that opening credits sequence where the killer is bobbing in and out of the water, we see him catch views of different things that just make the city look a bit dirty. And you know, I mean, like he views a Chinese restaurant and they're there prepping food stuff. And we see the guy just come and dump a bunch of garbage out the back into the canal out of the restaurant. And then he goes and he's spying on the prostitute and all that. And it's just really building this image of the city being, you know, not a terribly pretty place. And then that just continues as things go on, as we get to know our lead cop character. He's got this interaction with his daughter, which I want to talk more about the daughter later because I love her. But, you know, she's talking all about my bike was stolen. And of course, you cops don't do anything about it. And things are terrible. And there's just all this stuff, this layer upon layer upon layer, telling us that Amsterdam is a rotten place. I don't know if it really is, but this movie sure makes you believe that it is.
Although I have to admit, if my kid came in and pointed my gun, I mean, he should have stored his gun better, but if my kid came in, I was sitting in the bath and my kid comes and points a gun at me, I don't think I'm going to be that cool.
I admired him for, you know, being a single dad and trying to raise a teenage daughter on that, but he's not winning any parenting awards here. No. He does some awful stuff. Yeah, I want to get more to the daughter in a minute, but I want to jump back to something else you were saying here, where you were talking about kind of elements of horror going on here, as well as elements of a cop action type of a film and all that. And again, I think some of this is laid out really early in the film. As I was watching it, I really got a vibe for two genres that I associate more with the cinema of Italy. And that is what I would refer to as a Eurocrime film, or the Polizio Testi. Again, I'm no good with the pronunciations, but those Italian cop story type of things. You've certainly got elements of that going on here. And then also giallo films, which, you know, you can call those a brand of horror, but I think certainly when we're seeing things like from out of the view of the killer bobbing in and out of the water, and you've got the breathing, you know, sound, you know, coming through the apparatus that he's wearing, and, you know, then when the first murder happens, the, you know, like the blood that we see, you know, smeared across the pavement because he dragged the body back out in the water. You know, just a lot of different elements of giallo, you know, kind of throughout this film. But I think it establishes it right from that opening sequence.
Definitely. I think the only thing that really sort of, it didn't kill it for me, but it sort of dragged me up, it was the soundtrack's a bit too synthy for it to be sinister. Do you know what I mean? There's certain shots. As I say, certain shots, it kind of took the sinister away by being too synthy. I almost laughed at a couple of occasions.
It was going for that, that 80s synth vibe, which, of course, I mean, it's 1988, so, you know, it's to be figured. Going back to the giallo elements, I think one of the scenes that plays this out the best is the scene that then follows our first murder, where the body is discovered, which, I mean, I think we need to kind of break down some of the killings in this film, because if people are going to call this a slasher film, which a lot of sources refer to this as a slasher, I mean, that's the subject that people go to when they talk about slashers. And I think this first murder in the film, I mean, I don't know how any film could top this, to be honest with you, because I mean, we see the first murder happen, and to be honest, it's, you know, it's at a distance. We don't see that much. Again, we're kind of seeing it from the point of view of a bystander on the street who's seeing it from a distance, and it is brutal. We see the stabbing and all that stuff. But when the body is discovered, like I kind of said in the synopsis, it's hanging from one of these bridges that are all throughout Amsterdam, these little bridges that go over the canals. And we have a tour boat that's going through the canals, and it's filled with children, Boy Scouts, nuns, the tourists, they're all there. And this is a boat that's got a glass ceiling on it, and it literally bumps into this body that's hanging there, and it slides across the top of the boat. The blood smears across the windows, and then one of the windows is open, so the body flops down into it. I mean, I don't know how you beat that as the opening murder of a movie.
It was definitely the most voyeuristic, almost, I don't know if that's the right word, but definitely the most on display murder. It was like, it was very much a sort of opening night, look at me, sort of. And what made me laugh was the fact that as you say, she flops in through the hole in the roof, and she's absolutely dripping blood. And normally that would be maybe a long shot and a mannequin, but no, we got a right close-up shot of the poor actress.
She's staring right into the camera.
Staring right into the camera.
It's rough. I mean, and it is one of those scenes that, you know, you watch it and you go, oh, this is brutal. This is over the top. And at the same time, you can't help but kind of release a little laugh at it, just because, you know, I don't know if it is the tension or if it's just because it's so outlandish. But yeah, I couldn't help myself kind of laughing at that scene. And yeah, as soon as it played out, I knew there was no way that the film was going to, you know, be able to deliver another moment like that. It certainly tries. And I guess I'd turn it to you first. I mean, when it comes to some of the other other murders that happen here, what stands out for you?
Well, it stands out the sailor, the drunk sailor, who all of a sudden his boat starts moving and he's come trying to, and then his boat starts sinking and he it's not as showy, but it was definitely one that grabbed my attention, because for one thing, it was quite funny watching him bumble around absolutely off his face trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And then he grabs a shotgun. I'm like, oh, this is not
good. Well, and it's just like you're watching it too, because you've already seen several murders happen and you're like, what is this guy that's scuba diving like super strong or something? I mean, how's he doing this? You know,
this is, as I say, with the second murder, with the eco people doing the water testing, they get their depth gauge thing back up and it's absolutely crushed and mangled. And at this point, I'm thinking, is this more of a horror movie than the whole cop movie? Because I thought it was an equal balance at that point, and sort of looking at that and thinking, hang on a minute. Is he some kind of superhuman, like, because I was starting to get Maniac Cop vibes, the Bruce Campbell movie.
Oh, yeah.
About the cop who's thought to be dead, he went to prison, thought dead and actually wasn't, and now he's all annoyed and taking revenge on the city that shunned him. I started getting serious Maniac Cop vibes at that point. And then, of course, we find out what's happened to the killer later, but yeah. I did wonder, is this like something back from the dead, a monster from the deep?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or just the rubbish of the canals has amalgamated into a being that's annoyed at everyone in Amsterdam.
That would have been something, you know, because like I said, they do a lot to establish that people will just dump all kinds of crud into that water. Mm. So, yeah, that would have been great if it had been someone who had been mutated by all the garbage in the canals. I mean, you talked about these environmentalists, you know, that's kind of the second sequence that we have where a murder happens. And I mean, even them, I'm going, how much of an environmentalist can you really be? One of them is just about to urinate into the water when they suddenly have a problem. Yeah. And of course, I mean, their moment too just is going, I mean, it's really swinging for the fences when it comes to, you know, having a horror moment, because they realize there's some kind of a problem. They pull up anchor and there's a whole human head attached to the anchor.
That's certainly going to get you.
And, you know, the guy panics, jumps out of the water, swims, which again, I'm thinking, why is your thought to jump into the water? The water is filthy. We've established the water is filthy. And then he gets to the shore and gets dragged back in. Really, again, a cool horror moment. There's a bunch of cool horror moments. And I want to jump back to what you were saying about the one where the boat gets pulled into the water. Because then they go and investigate it later on, and I'm like, oh, well, here we go. This is clearly a salute to the Ben Gardner's boat scene from Jaws. They literally do their own version of that scene, and so help me, it works just as well.
Yeah, it does. You kind of know something's going to happen when he goes on to investigate the boat, but it still catches you by surprise when it actually happens.
Well, and then there's a battle that goes on, too, underneath, because the killer actually shows up. And that was pretty cool, too. Mm-hmm. I want to say, though, I think my favorite when it comes to beyond the first one, because the first one's in a league all of its own. But my favorite when it comes to the murders that happen here is the one of the girl that's sunbathing in the in the inflatable raft, which, again, it's like, we've seen over and over again in this movie that the canals are filthy. Yep. Why would you be in the canals? Here she is in an inflatable raft in this green bikini, lying there in the floating in the filthy canal sunbathing. But then just the way that it plays out, I just was like, oh my gosh, they're really going there. Because it's a clear raft, a clear inflatable raft. And we see the guy, again, we're looking point of view. He comes up from underneath, looks just like the opening of Jaws type of thing, coming up from underneath. And then we see from above, we see his face with the little mask on peering up through the clear raft. I was like, that is great. And then, of course, the knife comes up through it. And I don't want to get too off the charts here, guys, but I mean, we're literally looking at it crotch level on this person. Yeah. The knife comes up through and slices, and then we're just like, oh no. And again, it's just nuts. But you can't help but kind of have a little fun with a weird scene like that.
Yeah, you got to wonder how many of those little inflatable raft things they went through before they got the shot just right.
I also got to give some love to the weird scene with the lady from the Salvation Army. Because I mean, she ends up being another one of the victims. And the weird thing about that scene was that I just couldn't believe kind of, you know, what this person is doing. Again, maybe trying to create the seedy image of the city, because here she is, you know, in the whole Salvation Army uniform and such. She's walking around in a Mexican restaurant, shaking her little cup to get donations. I mean, literally shoving it in people's face and jiggling it, making the change rattle to get donations. And first of all, I'm thinking, what restaurant's going to allow someone to do that? You don't get away with that type of thing stateside. I don't know how it is there. I was also thinking, how many Mexican restaurants can there be in Amsterdam? That's got to be interesting. But I mean, they're all over the place where I live, of course, because I live in Colorado, but in Amsterdam. But anyway, and then when she leaves, she goes, and it sure looks to me like she's pocketing the money. She's like taking the money out of the jar and pocketing it for herself, which, you know, is again, like saying, this city is so bad, even the Salvation Army people are crooked.
Yep. I got serious, Save the Clock Tower from Back to the Future.
Oh, yes.
It reminded me so much of her, the way she just sticks the can in people's faces. And it's even worse than that lady, because as you say, they're in a restaurant, they're trying to enjoy their meal, and there's this woman rattling a tin cup in front of their face. But if it hadn't been for the eco guys, I actually started to wonder early on, is this, like you say, it's showing the seedy side of it. Is this like a morals-based thing? Is that what his motive is? Is he going after the people who are responsible or who he sees as part of the problem with Amsterdam being so seedy? But of course, the eco guys were actually trying to do something good, because they're trying to prove that this, whatever it was, the power station or whatever they were next to, was polluting the canals and the rivers. So,
except the one guy was trying to pee in the canal. So, maybe that's what got the killer upset at him. But you're right. I mean, the killings are pretty much completely random.
Mm. Yeah, I like the fact that it did keep you guessing throughout. You don't really know why he's doing it. It's not like a lot of these, like if you watch a Lethal Weapon movie, you see the villain as well, and you know why he's doing what he's doing. It's that all the way through, it was like, who the hell is this guy and why is he doing this?
Well, and I guess that's a good place to kind of talk about the killer in general, because I mean, this is a killer where it is kept pretty much a secret as to who they are and what their motivation is until, I mean, literally like the last 10 minutes or so of the movie. We never really even get a good look at them. They're always wearing the scuba mask, or in one point, like a helmet, because there's the whole boat chase thing. We got to talk about the boat chase. But, you know, there's never really any kind of moment where we get just a solid look at this killer. I mean, there's not even anything we can really attach to them as far as, like, you know, something identifiable, where we're like, oh yeah, it's the guy in the hockey mask, or, you know, oh, there's Mike Myers, you know, I know that face, you know, whatever. There's nothing like that. It's all kept very secretive. So I guess, you know, does that work for the film, or does that take away that we're kind of scratching our heads the whole time?
I liked it, as I say, apart from the fact that I will say that his mask, as much as it's not very identifiable, as you say, it's not like Mike Myers, it's very creepy. It's almost, obviously it was being Amsterdam, it's almost like a gimp mask or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
quite, quite a creepy looking diver's mask. Obviously, he's looking to hide certain things. But no, I like the fact that he really didn't know, and it felt like a challenge for lack of a better term, for the hero. It actually felt like he was struggling to deal with this, although he can drive a boat, luckily.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the boat scene, because there's actually two chases in this film. There's a brief chase involving a car and a motorcycle, mm-hmm. which, was a lot of fun. And I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about that was that all these streets that they're on, it's these these old streets that were built long before cars were a consideration. So you've got this motorcycle and this car weaving through these narrow spaces there and at very high speeds, narrowly missing pedestrians. I mean, it's the type of thing where you're going, oh my, was there a safety person on this film at all? Because it sure looked like he was about to hit that person.
I like the accuracy though, because the pedestrians, even though you've got this really loud siren blaring, a flashing light on your roof, nope, they're just going to wander out into the road anyway because no, I didn't see them. No, they should give way to me. They're in a high speed chase, so what? I'm going to the cafe or whatever.
Yeah, pedestrians have the right of way always. But I think the boat chase is the highlight. I'll turn it to you first. Tell us what you thought about the boat chase.
I thought it was brilliant. It was really sort of, as you say, the canals, they aren't big, so it's all high speed. It's all, and there's some really tight turns, and it really sort of draws you. I think the only bit that I didn't like was the bit where he somehow got hold of that float thing and smacked him in the head, and he somehow falls out of the boat perfectly rolling, missing the propeller, and there's that rope that he clings onto, and the boat just very nicely keeps going in a perfect straight line.
Right. And there's no driver. He's just being dragged behind it. Yeah, I wondered about that too. But yeah, I was thinking, man, it seems like he should be getting nicked by that motor at some point because he's awfully close to that boat motor. Yeah, it's a cool sequence. Like you said, lots of narrow canals there, lots of sharp turns. I mean, those bridges have these small openings, and a lot of them are like brick bridges. Where So you're going like, if they misjudge that, that's splat. That's not going to be good. And I mean, there's several sequences where they're making a turn there, and it sure looks like they're about to hit that thing. I think there's even one or two moments where they do bump back and forth against the walls of those bridges. And it's a great chase. It gets a little outlandish because, of course, you've got to have one jump over a bridge, you know, which, I mean, it actually, in a lot of moments there with that chase, reminded me a bit of the speedboat chase in Live and Let Die, which is my favorite Bond movie. You know, they're going through the Louisiana swamps there. I mean, I would say they probably were influenced by that a bit.
I was actually reading as well that I've got no idea how you pronounce it now, Hub Staple, he was actually injured filming that scene when stuntman, it was a mistake. He had to have 3 weeks off work and was left with a protruding rib. I cannot pronounce this, but he was left with constant serious pins and needles in his hands. That was a dedication to your craft there come back after that.
I guess so. Well, let's talk a bit about our lead performers here and the characters they play and all that. I guess, what's your take on this character that Hub Staple plays, on Visser? Like I said, kind of a tough cop, juggling a bunch of different things. How do you think he does here?
I thought he was an interesting protagonist. As I say, he does all the things you'd expect of a Hollywood 80s cop, but I guess he does the Dutch version. He's not doing everything to look like something out of Hollywood. I mean, like we said, he's got the mullet, he's got the leather jacket and the stubble and the aviators and the... He's beating up naughty little boys who are trying to play protection on the local cake store and all of that. But you kind of got the sense that he felt a bit closer to normal, I guess would be... So like when he first meets, I'm terrible with names, at the diving club, when they first meet, he's trying to be charming, and he is, but he's not really cool, if that was amazing. There's some missteps, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. He kind of fumbles his way through that whole thing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and later on, when they're on the date, and he just turns around and goes, so, sex.
Like, yeah.
But, smooth, Romeo.
Well, you almost get the impression like this is a guy who has not really had much of a chance to be in a relationship since he's busy 24/7, either doing police work or trying to manage his weird daughter. So, you know, he's probably a little bit out of his element. And that's something that comes into play, too, because, you know, when he first meets up with the other police guy, the guy from the, quote, River Police,
yep.
John, and, you know, he's a stark contrast to our lead here. He's got, like, he's this muscular guy. He's got this flowing blonde hair. He looks, I mean, when we first see him, he's wearing this bright yellow wetsuit. He very much looks like a surfer dude type of a guy, you know. And we find out that there is some past between these two characters because Visser, he had at one point stolen away John's girlfriend, who then ended up being the mother of the daughter that he's now trying to raise. And she ran off with an artist at some point and left him alone with the kids. So, you know, there's this whole weird dynamic between them. But I like the way these two cops work together. Right? You know, I thought there was an interesting contrast between the two. The one who's, like we say, kind of the tough guy cop, you know, just the by the book, hard as nails type of guy. And then you've got this river cop guy who's just a little bit more, I don't know, roll with it type of a guy, you know, a bit more of a pretty boy type that. I thought it was a nice dynamic between the two of them.
And then, of course, you had the third cop, the guy with glasses and the bald head who was just your typical nerd.
Yeah.
Typical 80s nerd, but even he was quite funny. He adds something to the dynamic. You've got these three very different people, but they're all working together and they work quite well together. Mm-hmm. I found him quite entertaining. They even got with the boat chase. I knew it was coming when he sort of got the rope at the back of the boat and Visser just floors it. He falls off the back. I was waiting for it to happen. I was like, there he goes.
Well, and I want to talk about the daughter. Because she factors into not the whole film. She's kind of here and there, but this was one of the weirdest parts of the movie and I thought was a lot of fun. Like we said, our lead character, Visser, has this daughter. She's like 13, 14 years old, something like that. And
going on 45.
Yeah. And the way that we're introduced to her, I mean, the first scene, after we've seen the first bit of bloodshed here, we cut to where we have our lead cop and he's relaxing in the bathtub. He's got the towel over his head. I mean, it literally looks like this is like the only moment of peace that this guy gets in a day. He's tired and, you know, just overwhelmed with stuff. And his daughter comes in. She has taken his gun out of his holster and comes into the bathroom and is pointing at it to get his attention. And his reaction is just like, this happens every day, because he's just like, be careful with that. It's loaded.
He doesn't even take the towel off of his face.
But then she's just a total snot to him. Yep. I mean, she just is ribbing him every chance she gets. She's insulting him. She tells him how he doesn't do anything right. He doesn't buy the right things at the store. Did you buy peanut butter this time? No, you didn't buy peanut butter. You know, how come your buddies at the police department can't find my bike? All that stuff. I mean, he's trying to get ready to go to work. The phone rings and it's headquarters. She picks it up and I'm going to censor myself here, but she's like, I don't know. I think he's in the bathroom. I think he's pleasuring himself. That's not the word that she uses. But and I'm like, oh, my gosh, what parent lets their daughter get away with this stuff?
Far too cynical for her age.
And then she pops up again several times through the film. And she's got this weird boyfriend named Willie, who fancies himself as some kind of psychic. And then they're like, you know, like there's this moment where they're sitting there eating McDonald's and he's like, oh, I can find the killer. Give me something related to the case. And so she gives him one of the bullets from her father's gun, which again, she's digging around in his stuff, you know, his gun, whatever. And so the kid is like holding the bullet and then he's like drawing circles on a map and he's like, oh, this is it. This is where they are. And they go out to be like, play Scooby-Doo or something like that and investigate this for themselves. And they have this wonderfully weird sequence there around the canals as they're trying to figure this whole thing out. And of course they just miss the killer. It's just weird.
So I've got to wonder what made Willie think I want to talk to dead people. what has happened to him? What has he seen in his life? Because he has terrible fashion sense, even by the 80s standards.
Oh, yeah.
Every time I saw him, I'm looking at him thinking, how did your mother let you even leave the house?
I was by no way, in with the fashion and all that back in the 80s when I was a teenager. I was a geek. I was, not one of the popular kids, but I dress better than Willie does. At least I've got that on my side.
There's me and there's this guy.
I mean, so help me. I mean, am I bad for saying this, but I kind of wanted Willie to end up being the next victim. I thought that's where the film was going to go, to be honest.
So did I. Because I read one of the synopsis, I think it was on IMDb, and it said how his girlfriend and his, the detective, his girlfriend and his daughter or his family get closer to the killer than he does. And I was really wondering what that meant. And then, of course, quite literally was nearer to the killer because he just bubbles up just at the last second after Willie has been unceremoniously fished out of the canal.
Well, on a whole, I mean, I think a lot of the cast members here really have some cool moments, get a chance to shine. The only kind of part of the cast and just the storyline, it's not so much the cast, but I guess where the storyline goes or things that I struggled with is we have this romantic, subplot between Visser and Laura. And I mean, it's kind of one of those things where it feels like it's there because someone thought we need to have a romantic subplot. It doesn't really contribute much to where the story goes. I mean, I suppose it does help a little bit with the ultimate reveal of the killer, which we'll talk about in a moment, but you could have done that other ways. Instead, you end up getting some little moments where there's not a lot going on, and it's just like we say, we're out on a date with our cop and this lady, and it's kind of like that's where the film drags, you know.
The scene after the date was it was when he goes to see her later, and he's all depressed because he's not getting anywhere, and the bosses are on to him. So obviously, he's got nasty with the motorbike subject in the interview room, and he goes to her a bit drunk and a bit, oh no, and then it goes into that awful sex scene. quick pan over to the rain, quicker, go.
Well, and it's it's almost a comical edit, really, when they go to the sex scene, because she's there talking to him and asking him things. And I don't remember the exact line, but she says something along the lines of, well, is there anything I can do for you? Cut, they're in bed. it's kind of cheesy. Well, we should start moving towards the break here, but we need to talk about the ultimate reveal. I mean, we've said many times in the past we don't shy away from spoilers on this show. We have talked about a number of spoilers as we've gone throughout here, because we've talked about the different set pieces with the murders and such like that. But if you don't want to know the ultimate reveal of the killer here, I guess maybe skip ahead a few moments. But basically, the whole film, it's kind of, they're laying the seeds that seem to point towards this wealthy guy that they met at the scuba club, Martin Ruisdael. He's a rich psychiatrist, something like that. And, he talks about how he used to dive a lot, but he hasn't dived in many years, all that type of thing. It really seems to be pointing towards he's going to be the killer. Okay. He's also interested in the girl, in Laura, so that our cop is dating and all that kind of stuff. So we figure, all right, this is clearly going to be the killer.
Practically setting up landing lights like for the runway.
Exactly.
Pointing directly at him.
But turns out that is not the way things go. It turns out that the killer is actually a childhood friend of Roysdale's who he used to dive with. And this guy then in his adult life became an actual professional diver. He became a salvage diver. It's what he did for a living. And there was an incident where he was hired to do this dive. There was some uranium hexafluoride involved. And
it's
so
an 80s movie. Of course, there's toxic waste involved.
Yes. And he ends up getting disfigured and all that. And so, you know, this ends up being just a revenge against humanity type of a thing, I guess. And, you know, we do briefly see him. He takes off the scuba outfit and he's pale white and disfigured. He looks like Darth Vader without his mask on, literally.
I went with Toxic Avenger, but yeah.
It's a bit Toxic Avenger. I also thought a bit of Pinhead from Hellraiser. Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of that kind of look to it. But I guess before we reveal the ultimate fate of the killer, I guess, what did you think about this when we, you know, reveal this is our killer?
Well, I thought it was pointing at Martin, but is it pointing at Martin because we're meant to think it's Martin, not because it's actually him? And then the reveal and how he'd said about, oh, there was an incident when I was younger, so I stopped diving. And then you find out the incident was this horrible thing that happened to his childhood friend. And you, the thing about them not saying that there was this horrible, nasty uranium waste down there that disfigured him. Yeah, in this day and age, even in this day and age, I think big corporations lie about something like that. Yeah, I can see that happening. And then, of course, it all makes sense that the diving mask. And again, because she obviously nails Martin with the oar. And that was a beautiful shot. I thought that was really well done. How he goes down hard.
Yeah.
And you think, as cool as that was, this was too easy. And then the guy pops up out of the water. Luckily, our hero is there with his trusty sidearm to put, I lost count of how many rounds he actually hit him with, and he still managed to swim away, which brought me again back to this whole idea of, oh, is he like superhuman now? Have we gone down that angle? We went down that alleyway. And then after that, when they track him to his home, and obviously he's living with rats, and I quite like the fact that it wasn't, normally that would be the final showdown. He's going to go out in a blaze of glory, or he's going to do one last thing before it's over. And it almost felt a bit anticlimactic, but in a good way. It felt in a good way, though. I like that they did something different. It didn't go in there and, like, the hero's already done his bit. And as much as I'm impressed that he was able to walk around, swim home, and then walk around his very grotty flat and say hello to his rats and then stick a spear gun in his mouth. which again I thought looked very cool. It was the makeup effects were really cool on how they did that last bit.
Again, it's another moment that harkened back to like Giallo films for me, where,
and that's just it. The only thing that made me laugh was they got this Martin under arrest. I mean, he'd also injured. And they're going in to deal with the killer, and they just leave him in the car. He's not handcuffed. He's not got anyone watching him, just in case the killer gets past him. They just leave him in the car.
Mm.
But no, I actually liked the way they ended it. As I say, I liked the fact that they did something different. It wasn't this big explosive finale that you didn't see coming, or you did see coming. It was probably one of the more grounded moments of the film, in that they get there. I mean, as we're recording this, they're hunting a guy in London who threw an alkali substance in a woman's face, and she and her daughter suffered apparent life-changing injuries. And their working theory now is that he's actually, because he suffered an injury himself, he actually died and fallen in the River Thames. That was in the news. And as I say, we've been watching this for days thinking, how haven't they found him yet? And as much as it's just a theory at this point, it does actually make sense.
Yeah. Well, you're right that I think that might be one of the most grounded moments of the film. I don't know that I appreciated it as much as you did, because I think I was primed for something big because there had been so much other just crazy moments in this film. To have it end with the killer basically eliminating himself, I was like, oh, that's definitely not where I expected things to go, considering how crazy this movie was. Yeah. Well, we should take it to the break here, but I'll give you a chance for any final thoughts you have here on Amsterdam.
It's on the one hand, it's an 80s super cheese fest, but it's done slightly different because this is the Dutch version. And I was actually quite entertained. And I imagine this would be quite a fun watch with your mates, you know, sit down on a Saturday night, put a good film on. That's a film you can have a laugh with and enjoy and really get into.
Yeah, I agree. I think I do think this would be fun with a crowd. I mean, it's if you're into stuff from like Canon films, that type of thing, I think this is very much in the vein of the stuff we were seeing out of Canon in the 80s. It's a unique, wild little ride, and I had a lot of fun with it as well. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hey, Jay, can I ask you a question?
Sure, Mark. Far away.
How come Carter's always sliding around in Deep Blue Sea?
Wow.
And how come Preacher has a bird in the kitchen?
I think...
Should Janice have won an Oscar for all that exposition?
Yeah, I mean...
Who do the sharks hate the most? How far did Jim travel underwater?
About...
Why do they keep calling Brenda Tower?
Mark, please, we've already covered all of these topics and many, many more on Deep Blue Sea, the podcast.
You mean the podcast where we analyze Rennie Harlan's 1999 masterpiece, Deep Blue Sea, chapter by chapter?
Exactly! Find it everywhere podcasts can be found.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can help support this show and earn access to some great bonus features. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more, and we thank you for your support.
Hi, I'm Jason Soto.
And I'm Lisa Leahy.
And we're the host of Between the Scares, a podcast that takes a look at every movie that Blumhouse Productions has made. You may not recognize the name, but they have made some of your favorite horror movies like Paranormal Activity, Ouija, and Insidious.
Yeah, Jason, but they've also made stupid movies like The Fever and Best Night Ever and Hysterical Blindness.
Yeah, those two. But they also did Whiplash, Get Out, and Us, and we're going to cover it all.
Hey, did you know that Jason Blum also produced that Gem and the Holograms live-action movie?
He did that?
Uh-huh.
Ugh. Fine. But then you have to watch The Green Inferno. So listen to Between the Scares on Anchor, Apple, Google, Amazon, or our home location at rabbitholepodcast.com.
Jim Rex? What's Jim Rex? Would you believe a movie audience guide presented as a public service by this theater's management to help you select your motion picture entertainment? Well, that's what it is. And we urge you to learn these rating symbols and use them as a guide for you and your family. G means suggested for general audiences, all ages. M, suggested for mature audiences, parental discretion advised. R, restricted, persons under 16 not admitted unless accompanied by parent or adult guardian. X, persons under 16 will not be admitted. This seal in advertising indicates that the film was approved under the Motion Picture Code of Self-Regulation.
All right, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie that we've enjoyed. It could be anything. It could be a new release. It could be a forgotten film. It could be something that you saw on a streaming service. It could be anything. So, Simon, what is your recommendation?
Well, I'm going to take us back to the year 1999. Long time ago now. Scary.
Yeah.
It's not The Matrix. It is more of a forgotten film, but it's not the version that most people will think of. It's Mel Gibson's Payback, but it's the director's cut, which didn't hit the cinemas. It was released years later because Brian Helgeland, his directorial debut, was famously taken off it because, as usual, the studio didn't like the direction it was going in, including the fact that he killed the dog. And so years later, he was given the chance to put together his cut of the movie the way he wanted it to be and released it on Blu-ray. And I think it is, I mean, I like the theatrical cut, but I think his version is far superior. I don't know how it's possible. It's even more gritty, and it's just slight tweaks on the theatrical cut for the first two thirds. The scene that, that includes, you get more of Mel Gibson's Porter with, I should probably explain that it's obviously Porter is a common criminal. He robs some people of $730,000, and his share is stolen by his partner, played by Greg Henry. He's betrayed by Greg Henry's character Val Resnick and his, and Porter's own wife. And then once he's nursed back to health, he comes back for the money he wants, and no one can quite believe that he's going through all this trouble to get such what they consider such a small amount of money. But anyway, the visiting of Porter to his wife is played by Cara Deborah Unger. It's a lot more expanding. There's this brilliant scene where they have a fight in the kitchen, and she apparently was very disappointed that it didn't make the theatrical cut because she secretly broke a rib filming that scene. She went through quite a lot. But the final act of the movie is completely different from the theatrical cut, and it's so much better. It's so clever. The big boss you never see on screen like you do in the theatrical cut, and then instead of Porter being captured after a gunfight and dragged off and hammer to toes and all of that, you get him going to the supposed meet where they're going to give him his money, so as he goes away and he just discreetly slinks around checking for the people who are going to be there to try and kill him, and he just eliminates them slowly in interesting ways. And I haven't watched it in a few years. I've got the Blu-ray with both versions on, and I watched it a few weeks back. I remember thinking, this is a good movie. It's not a deep movie, but it is 90 minutes of just, it's good fun, even though he's definitely an anti-hero at best. Just watching him outsmart all of the massive crime organization, corrupt cops and small-time criminals, is, and he just got such a simple outlook and a simple way of doing things, and there's a code to him. It's just a film I love, and I haven't watched it in years, and finally revisited it and had an absolute blast with it.
Well, it sounds like I need to revisit it as well. I don't think I have seen this since probably 1999 when it came out, and I definitely haven't seen the director's cut of it, so my memories of this film are very vague. So yeah, one I should revisit, I guess. All right. Well, the movie that I am going to recommend, I was trying to think of like another masked killer movie that I could recommend, and, you know, not go to the ones we always hear. I mean, you know, I don't want to do like Halloween or Friday the 13th, things like that. Everybody knows those movies. So I actually decided to recommend a movie from just last year that, at least here in the U.S., was one that came out on Amazon Prime, and it's called Totally Killer. And this is kind of like Halloween meets Back to the Future. It stars an actress named Kiernan Shipka, who I admit I'm not familiar with other than this movie. I thought she was great in this movie. I'd like to see other things she's been in. But she plays a teenage girl who lives in this town where back in the 80s, there was a masked killer on the loose, a killer dubbed the Sweet 16 Killer, because he killed several girls, stabbing them 16 times on their 16th birthdays. And but what there was one girl who famously got away, and that was the mother of our lead character. But now here we are all these years later, and the killer comes back and kills the mother. And so, to make a long story short, this girl, she has a best friend who is a bit of a science nerd and has built a time machine. Yes, a time machine in an abandoned amusement park. And our lead girl ends up going back in time to 1987, where she tries to stop the killer. And of course, in the process, ends up meeting and befriending her mother as a teen. It's a crazy out idea, but it strangely works. And of course, you know, one of the things I think I enjoyed the most about it is just the 80s vibe. It's a bit surreal to me now because, you know, here we have time travel movies where they go back in time and encounter the parents of the lead character when they were teenagers. And, you know,
I was a teenager in the 80s. So, like, now I'm George McFly, you know, from Back to the Future, because now they're making movies about my generation where they go back in time and visit it. You know, it's the stuff that makes you feel old, I guess. But, you know, I thought the script was very clever. It has some fun bits where it really plays off of kind of the differences between teens today and teens back in the 80s. Like, there's a number of moments where, like, the teenage characters from the 80s will say something or do something, and this girl who's traveled back in time is like, you can't do that, you can't say that. It's like, no, it's a different world, you know. But anyway, it also kind of plays with a bunch of the horror movie tropes, kind of in the same vein of something like Scream, you know. But it's a film that I think, you know, really, even though as weird as it is, really works. And like I said, I think it goes a long way on the strength of the lead actress, Kiernan Shipka. She really carries the movie, has a great screen presence, and does a great job. So, I mean, as goofy as this film is, it's a film that I think realizes that it's a bit goofy, and it really makes it work in its favor.
It sounds a lot like Freaky, the one with Vince Vaughn in, and Catherine, I can't think of her name, where their personalities get switched. And so Vince Vaughn is essentially playing a teenage girl, and the mind of the anonymous killer has been moved into the teenage girl. And he obviously uses it to go around a whole access to a whole new level of victims, whereas teenage girl Vince Vaughn is trying to figure out how to get back to his body. But no, I recognize the poster for it. I have heard of this. It didn't really draw my attention, but now it does. I will be watching this, especially as it's available to stream on Amazon Prime. I'll definitely be checking that one out.
Excellent. Well, Simon, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find all the stuff you're working on out there.
Well, my site is The Movie Mustache. You can find me at moviemustache.com. You can find me on Facebook, X, Instagram, and Threads, all at movie_mustache. Apart from Facebook, which is at movie_mustache2.0, because for some reason Facebook blocked the first page for spamming because I sent movie content to a movie group. I haven't figured that one out yet. But yeah, as you said earlier, I do reviews, trailer reactions, occasional news pieces. And recently I've been getting into my rewatches. So last year, obviously, did the rewatch of the Mission Impossible movies before Dead Reckoning came out. Although I haven't actually got around to seeing Dead Reckoning yet. And I'm currently working on a rewatch of all of the Bourne movies because they're talking about making another one of those, which I won't give too much away, but I have mixed feelings about. Please come and read what I write about it and let me know what you think as well.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that's going to do it for this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read some more reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. We welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And while you're at it, leave us a positive comment over at iTunes or wherever you download the show. And be sure to visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. And I also want to mention a few other podcasts that I've been on in recent weeks that you can check out. I was on a recent episode of Out Now with Aaron and Abe, where we talked about the new release Argyle. So be sure to give that one a listen. And I was also on the Direct-to-Video Connoisseur podcast with Matt Poirier, who guested on this show a few weeks back. We discussed the film Welcome to Willits, which features a very small appearance by Dolph Lundgren. Thanks again for listening to this show, and we'll see you again real soon. Thank you.
reason to be afraid. I do judo.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.